For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
The Course of the World's History, Subsection 2. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Introduction 2, The Philosophy of History, by Georg Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel. On the Course of the World's History, Subsection 2. Universal history, as already demonstrated, shows the development of the consciousness of freedom on the part of spirit, and of the consequent realization of that freedom. This development implies a gradation, a series of increasingly adequate expressions or manifestations of freedom, which result from its idea. The logical and, as still more prominent, the dialectical nature of the idea in general, namely, that it is self-determined, that it assumes successive forms which it successively transcends, and by this very process of transcending its earlier stages, gains an affirmative and, in fact, a richer and more concrete shape, this necessity of its nature and the necessary series of pure abstract forms, which the idea successively assumes, is exhibited in the department of logic. Here we need adopt only one of its results, namely, that every step in the process, as differing from any other, has its determinate peculiar principle. In history, this principle is idiosyncrasy of spirit, peculiar national genius. It is within the limitations of this idiosyncrasy that the spirit of the nation, concretely manifested, expresses every aspect of its consciousness and will, the whole cycle of its realization. Its religion, its polity, its ethics, its legislation, and even its science, art, and mechanical skill, all bear its stamp. These special peculiarities find their key in that common peculiarity, the particular principle that characterizes a people, as, on the other hand, in the facts which history presents in detail, that most common characteristic principle may be detected. That such or such a specific quality constitutes the peculiar genius of a people is the element of our inquiry which must be derived from experience, and historically proved. To accomplish this presupposes not only a disciplined faculty of abstraction, but an intimate acquaintance with the idea. The investigator must be familiar a priori, if we like to call it so, with the whole circle of conceptions to which the principles in question belong, just as Kepler, to name the most illustrious example in this mode of philosophizing, must have been familiar a priori with ellipses, with cubes and squares, and with ideas of their relations before he could discover, from the empirical data, those immortal laws of his, which are none other than forms of thought pertaining to those classes of conceptions. He who is unfamiliar with the science that embraces these abstract elementary conceptions is as little capable, though he may have gazed on the firmament and the motions of the celestial bodies for a lifetime, of understanding those laws as of discovering them. From this want of acquaintance with the ideas that relate to the development of freedom proceed a part of those objections which are brought against the philosophical consideration of a science usually regarded as one of mere experience. The so-called a priori method and the attempt to insinuate ideas into the empirical data of history being the chief points in the indictment. Where this deficiency exists, such conceptions appear alien, not lying within the object of investigation. To minds whose training has been narrow and merely subjective, which have not an acquaintance and familiarity with ideas, they are something strange, not embraced in the notion and conception of the subject which their limited intellect forms. Hence, the statement that philosophy does not understand such sciences. It must, indeed, allow that it has not that kind of understanding which is the prevailing one in the domain of those sciences, that it does not proceed according to the categories of such understanding, but according to the categories of reason, though at the same time recognizing that understanding and its true value and position. It must be observed that in this very process of scientific understanding, it is of importance that the essential should be distinguished and brought into relief in contrast with the so-called non-essential. But in order to render this possible, we must know what is essential, and that is, in view of the history of the world in general, the consciousness of freedom and the phases which this consciousness assumes in developing itself. The bearing of historical facts on this category is their bearing on the truly essential, of the difficulties stated and the opposition exhibited to comprehensive conceptions in science. Part must be referred to the inability to grasp and understand ideas. If, in natural history, some monstrous hybrid growth is alleged as an objection to the recognition of clear and indubitable classes or species, a sufficient reply is furnished by a sentiment, often vaguely urged, that the exception confirms the rule, that is the part of a well-defined rule to show the conditions in which it applies, or the deficiency or hybridism of cases that are abnormal. Mere nature is too weak to keep its genera and species pure when conflicting with alien elementary influences. If, for example, on considering the human organization in its concrete aspect, we assert that brain, heart, and so forth are essential to its organic life, some miserable abortion may be adduced which has, on the whole, the human form, or parts of it, which has been conceived in a human body, and has breathed after birth therefrom, in which, nevertheless, no brain and no heart is found. If such an instance is quoted against the general conception of a human being, the objector persisting in using the name, coupled with a superficial idea respecting it, it can be proved that a real, concrete human being is a truly different object, that such a being must have a brain in its head and a heart in its breast. A similar process of reasoning is adopted in reference to the correct assertion that genius, talent, moral virtues, and sentiments, and piety may be found in every zone, under all political constitutions and conditions, in confirmation of which examples are forthcoming in abundance. If in this assertion, the accompanying distinctions are intended to be repudiated as unimportant or non-essential, reflection evidently limits itself to abstract categories and ignores the specialities of the object in question, which certainly fall under no principle recognized by such categories. That intellectual position which adopts such merely formal points of view presents a vast field for ingenious questions, erudite views and striking comparisons, for profound-seeming reflections and declamations, which may be rendered so much the more brilliant in proportion as the subject they refer to is indefinite, and are susceptible of new and varied forms in inverse proportion to the importance of the results that can be gained from them, and the certainty and rationality of their issues. under such an aspect, the well-known Indian epopees may be compared with the Homeric. Perhaps, since it is the vastness of the imagination by which poetical genius proves itself, preferred to them, as, on account of the similarity of single strokes of imagination in the attributes of the divinities, it has been contended that Greek mythological forms may be recognized in those of India. Similarly, the Chinese philosophy, as adopting the One as its basis, has been alleged to be the same as at a later period appeared as Eleatic philosophy and as the Spinozistic system, while, in virtue of its expressing itself also in abstract numbers and lines, Pythagorean and Christian principles have been supposed to be detected in it. Instances of bravery and indomitable courage, traits of magnanimity, of self-denial and self-sacrifice, which are found among the most savage and the most pusillanimous nations, are regarded as sufficient to support the view that in these nations as much of social virtue and morality may be found as in the most civilized Christian states, or even more. And on this ground a doubt has been suggested whether in the progress of history and of general culture mankind have become better, whether their morality has been increased, morality being regarded in a subjective aspect and view as founded on what the agent holds to be right and wrong, good and evil, not on a principle which is considered to be in and for itself right and good, or a crime and evil, or on a particular religion believed to be the true one. We may fairly decline on this occasion the task of tracing the formalism and error of such a view, and establishing the true principles of morality, or, rather, of social virtue, in opposition to false morality. For the history of the world occupies a higher ground than that on which morality has properly its position, which is personal character, the conscience of individuals, their particular will, and mode of action. These have a value, imputation, reward, or punishment proper to themselves. What the absolute aim of spirit requires and accomplishes, what providence does, transcends the obligation and the liability to imputation and the ascription of good or bad motives, which attach to individuality in virtue of its social relations. They who, on moral grounds, and consequently with noble intention, have resisted that which the advance of the spiritual idea makes necessary, stand higher in moral worth than those whose crimes have been turned into the means, under the direction of a superior principle, of realizing the purposes of that principle. But in such revolutions, both parties generally stand within the limits of the same circle of transient and corruptible existence. Consequently, it is only a formal rectitude, deserted by the living spirit and by God, which those who stand upon ancient right and order maintain. The deeds of great men, who are the individuals of the world's history, thus appear not only justified in view of that intrinsic result of which they were not conscious, but also from the point of view occupied by the secular moralist. But looked at from this point, moral claims that are irrelevant must not be brought into collision with world historical deeds and their accomplishment. The litany of private virtues, modesty, humility, philanthropy, and forbearance, must not be raised against them. The history of the world might, on principle, entirely ignore the circle within which morality and the so much talked-of distinction between the moral and the politic lies, not only in abstaining from judgments, for the principles involved and the necessary reference of the deeds in question to those principles are a sufficient judge of them, but in leaving individuals quite out of view and unmentioned. What it has to record is the activity of the spirit of peoples, so that the individual forms which that spirit has assumed in the sphere of outward reality might be left to the delineation of special histories. The same kind of formalism avails itself, in its peculiar manner, of the indefiniteness attaching to genius, poetry, and even philosophy, thinks equally that it finds these everywhere. We have here products of reflective thought, and it is familiarity with those general conceptions which single out and name real distinctions without fathoming the true depth of the matter that we call culture. It is something merely formal, inasmuch as it aims at nothing more than the analysis of the subject, whatever it be, into its constituent parts, and the comprehension of these in their logical definitions and forms. It is not the free universality of conception necessary for making an abstract principle the object of consciousness. Such a consciousness of thought itself and of its forms isolated from a particular object is philosophy. This has, indeed, the condition of its existence in culture, that condition being the taking up of the object of thought, and at the same time clothing it with the form of universality, in such a way that the material content and the form given by the intellect are held in an inseparable state, inseparable to such a degree that the object in question, which, by the analysis of one conception into a multitude of conceptions, is enlarged to an incalculable treasure of thought, is regarded as a merely empirical datum, in whose formation thought has had no share. But it is quite as much an act of thought, of the understanding in particular, to embrace in one simple conception an object which of itself comprehends a concrete and large significance, as earth, man, Alexander, or Caesar, and to designate it by one word, as to resolve such a conception, duly to isolate in idea the conceptions which it contains, and to give them particular names. And in reference to the view which gave occasion to what has just been said, thus much will be clear, that as reflection produces what we include under the general terms genius, talent, art, science, formal culture, on every grade of intellectual development, not only can, but must grow and attain a mature bloom, while the grade in question is developing itself to a state, and on this basis of civilization is advancing to intelligent reflection and to general forms of thought, as in laws, so in regard to all else. In the very association of men in a state lies the necessity of formal culture, consequently of the rise of the sciences and of a cultivated poetry and art generally. The arts designated plastic require besides, even in their technical aspect, the civilized association of men. The poetic art, which has less need of external requirements and means, and which has the element of immediate existence, the voice, as its material, steps forth with great boldness and with matured expression, even under the conditions presented by a people not yet united in a political combination, since, as remarked above, language attains on its own particular ground a high intellectual development prior to the commencement of civilization. Philosophy also must make its appearance where political life exists, since that in virtue of which any series of phenomena is reduced within the sphere of culture, as above stated, is the form strictly proper to thought, and thus, for philosophy, which is nothing other than the consciousness of this form itself, the thinking of thinking. The material of which its edifice is to be constructed is already prepared by general culture. If in the development of the state itself periods are necessitated which impel the soul of nobler natures to seek refuge from the present in ideal regions, in order to find in them that harmony with itself which it can no longer enjoy in the discordant real world, where the reflective intelligence attacks all that is holy and deep, which had been spontaneously inwrought into the religion, laws, and manners of nations, and brings them down and attenuates them to abstract godless generalities. Thought will be compelled to become thinking reason, with the view of effecting in its own element the restoration of its principles from the ruin to which they had been brought. We find, then, it is true, among all world historical peoples, poetry, plastic art, science, even philosophy. But not only is there a diversity in style and bearing generally, but still more remarkably in subject matter. And this is a diversity of the most important kind, affecting the rationality of that subject matter. It is useless for a pretentious aesthetic criticism to demand that our good pleasure should not be made the rule for the matter, the substantial part of their contents, and to maintain that it is the beautiful form as such, the grandeur of the fancy, and so forth, which fine art aims at, and which must be considered and enjoyed by a liberal taste and cultivated mind. A healthy intellect does not tolerate such abstractions, and cannot assimilate productions of the kind above referred to. Granted that the Indian epopees might be placed on a level with the Homeric, on account of a number of those qualities of form, grandeur of invention and imaginative power, liveliness of images and emotions, and beauty of diction, yet the infinite difference of matter remains, consequently, one of substantial importance and involving the interest of reason, which is immediately concerned with the consciousness of the idea of freedom and its expression in individuals. There is not only a classical form, but a classical order of subject matter. And in a work of art, form and subject matter are so closely united that the former can only be classical to the extent to which the latter is so. With a fantastical indeterminate material, and rule is the essence of reason, the form becomes measureless and formless, or mean and contracted. In the same way, in that comparison of the various systems of philosophy of which we have already spoken, the only point of importance is overlooked, namely, the character of that unity which is found alike in the Chinese, the Eleatic, and the Spinozistic philosophy, the distinction between the recognition of that unity as abstract and as concrete, concrete to the extent of being a unity in and by itself, a unity synonymous with spirit. But that coordination proves that it recognizes only such an abstract unity, so that while it gives judgment respecting philosophy, it is ignorant of that very point which constitutes the interest of philosophy. But there are also spheres which, amid all the variety that is presented in the substantial content of a particular form of culture, remain the same. The difference above mentioned in art, science, philosophy concerns the thinking reason and freedom, which is the self-consciousness of the former and which has the same one root with thought. As it is not the brute, but only the man that thinks, he only, and only because he is a thinking thing, has freedom. His consciousness imports this that the individual comprehends itself as a person, that is, recognizes itself in its single existence as possessing universality, as capable of abstraction from and of surrendering all speciality, and therefore as inherently infinite. Consequently, those spheres of intelligence which lie beyond the limits of this consciousness are a common ground among those substantial distinctions. Even morality, which is so intimately connected with the consciousness of freedom, can be very pure while that consciousness is still wanting, as far, that is to say, as it expresses duties and rights only as objective commands, or even as far as it remains satisfied with the merely formal elevation of the soul, the surrender of the sensual and of all sensual motives, in a purely negative, self-denying fashion. The Chinese morality, since Europeans have become acquainted with it and with the writings of Confucius, has obtained the greatest praise and proportionate attention from those who are familiar with Christian morality. There is a similar acknowledgement of the sublimity with which the Indian religion and poetry, a statement that must, however, be limited to the higher kind, but especially the Indian philosophy, expatiate upon and demand the removal and sacrifice of sensuality. Yet both these nations are, it must be confessed, entirely wanting in the essential consciousness of the idea of freedom. To the Chinese, their moral laws are just like natural laws, external positive commands, claims established by force, compulsory duties or rules of courtesy towards each other. Freedom, through which alone the essential determinations of reason become moral sentiments, is wanting. Morality is a political affair, and its laws are administered by officers of government and legal tribunals. Their treatises upon it, which are not law books, but are certainly addressed to the subject of will and individual disposition, read, as do the moral writings of the Stoics, like a string of commands stated as necessary for realizing the goal of happiness, so that it seems to be left free to men, on their part, to adopt such commands, to observe them or not, while the conception of an abstract subject, a wise man, forms the culminating point among the Chinese, as also among the Stoic moralists. Also, in the Indian doctrine of the renunciation of the sensuality of desires and earthly interests, positive moral freedom is not the object and end, but the annihilation of consciousness, spiritual, and even physical privation of life. It is the concrete spirit of a people which we have distinctly to recognize, and since it is spirit, it can only be comprehended spiritually, that is, by thought. It is this alone which takes the lead in all the deeds and tendencies of that people, and which is occupied in realizing itself, in satisfying its ideal and becoming self-conscious, for its great business is self-production. But for spirit, the highest attainment is self-knowledge, an advance not only to the intuition but to the thought, the clear conception of itself. This it must and is also destined to accomplish. But the accomplishment is at the same time its dissolution, and the rise of another spirit, another world historical people, another epoch of universal history. This transition and connection leads us to the connection of the whole, the idea of the world's history as such, which we have now to consider more closely, and of which we have to give a representation. End The Course of the World's History, Subsection 2. This recording is in the public domain. The Course of the World's History, Subsection 3. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Introduction to The Philosophy of History by Georg Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel. The Course of the World's History, Subsection 3. History in general is therefore the development of spirit in time, as nature is the development of the idea in space. If then we cast a glance over the world's history generally, we see a vast picture of changes and transactions, of infinitely manifold forms of peoples, states, individuals, in unresting succession. Everything that can enter into and interest the soul of man, all our sensibility to goodness, beauty, and greatness, is called into play. On every hand, aims are adopted and pursued, which we recognize, whose accomplishment we desire. We hope and fear for them. In all these occurrences and changes, we behold human action and suffering predominant, everywhere something akin to ourselves, and therefore everywhere something that excites our interest, for or against. Sometimes it attracts us by beauty, freedom, and rich variety, sometimes by energy, such as enables even vice to make itself interesting. Sometimes we see the more comprehensive mass of some general interest advancing with comparative slowness, and subsequently sacrificed to an infinite complication of trifling circumstances, and so dissipated into atoms. Then, again, with a vast expenditure of power, a trivial result is produced, while from what appears unimportant, a tremendous issue proceeds. On every hand, there is the motliest throng of events drawing us within the circle of its interest, and when one combination vanishes, another immediately appears in its place. The general thought, the category which first presents itself in this restless mutation of individuals and peoples, existing for a time and then vanishing, is that of change at large. The sight of the ruins of some ancient sovereignty directly leads us to contemplate this thought of change in its negative aspect. What traveler among the ruins of Carthage, of Palmyra, Persepolis, or Rome has not been stimulated to reflections on the transiency of kingdoms and men, and to sadness at the thought of a vigorous and rich life now departed? A sadness which does not expend itself on personal losses and the uncertainty of one's own undertakings, but is a disinterested sorrow at the decay of a splendid and highly cultured national life. But the next consideration which allies itself with that of change is that change, while it imports dissolution, involves at the same time the rise of a new life, that while death is the issue of life, life is also the issue of death. This is a grand conception, one which the Oriental thinkers attained, and which is perhaps the highest in their metaphysics. In the idea of metempsychosis, we find it evolved in its relation to individual existence, but a myth more generally known is that of the phoenix, as a type of the life of nature, eternally preparing for itself its funeral pile, and consuming itself upon it, but so that from its ashes is produced the new, renovated, fresh life. But this image is only Asiatic, Oriental, not Occidental. Spirit, consuming the envelope of its existence, does not merely pass into another envelope, nor rise rejuvenescent from the ashes of its previous form. It comes forth exalted, glorified, a purer spirit. It certainly makes war upon itself, consumes its own existence. But in this very destruction, it works up that existence into a new form, and each successive phase becomes in its turn a material, working on which it exalts itself to a new grade. If we consider spirit in this aspect, regarding its changes not merely as rejuvenescent transitions, that is, returns to the same form, but rather as manipulations of itself by which it multiplies the material for future endeavors, we see it exerting itself in a variety of modes and directions, developing its powers, and gratifying its desires in a variety which is inexhaustible, because every one of its creations, in which it has already found gratification, meets it anew as material, and is a new stimulus to plastic activity. The abstract conception of mere change gives place to the thought of spirit manifesting, developing, and perfecting its powers in every direction which its manifold nature can follow. What powers it inherently possesses, we learn from the variety of products and formations which it originates. In this pleasurable activity, it has to do only with itself, as involved with the conditions of mere nature, internal and external. It will indeed meet in these not only opposition and hindrance, but will often see its endeavors thereby fail, often sink under the complications in which it is entangled, either by nature or by itself. But in such case, it perishes in fulfilling its own destiny and proper function, and even thus exhibits the spectacle of self-demonstration as spiritual activity. The very essence of spirit is activity. It realizes its potentiality, makes itself its own deed, its own work, and thus it becomes an object to itself, contemplates itself as an objective existence. Thus is it with the spirit of a people. It is a spirit having strictly defined characteristics, which erects itself into an objective world that exists and persists in a particular religious form of worship, customs, constitution, and political laws. In the whole complex of its institutions, in the events and transactions that make up its history, that is its work. That is what this particular nation is. Nations are what their deeds are. Every Englishman will say, "We are the men who navigate the ocean and have the commerce of the world, to whom the East Indies belong and their riches, who have a parliament, juries, etc." The relation of the individual to that spirit is that he appropriates to himself this substantial existence, that it becomes his character and capability, enabling him to have a definite place in the world, to be something. For he finds the being of the people to which he belongs an already established, firm world, objectively present to him, with which he has to incorporate himself. In this its work, therefore, its world, the spirit of the people, enjoys its existence and finds its satisfaction. A nation is moral, virtuous, vigorous, while it is engaged in realizing its grand objects, and defends its work against external violence during the process of giving to its purposes an object of existence. The contradiction between its potential subjective being, its inner aim and life, and its actual being is removed. It has attained full reality, has itself objectively present to it. But this having been attained, the activity displayed by the spirit of the people in question is no longer needed. It has its desire. The nation can still accomplish much in war and peace at home and abroad. But the living substantial soul itself may be said to have ceased its activity. The essential supreme interest has consequently vanished from its life, for interest is present only where there is opposition. The nation lives the same kind of life as the individual when passing from maturity to old age. In the enjoyment of itself, in the satisfaction of being exactly what it desired and was able to attain. Although its imagination might have transcended that limit, it nevertheless abandoned any such aspirations as objects of actual endeavor, if the real world was less than favorable to their attainment, and restricted its aim by the conditions thus imposed. This mere customary life, the watch wound up and going on of itself, is that which brings on natural death. Custom is activity without opposition, for which there remains only a formal duration, in which the fullness and zest that originally characterized the aim of life is out of the question, a merely external sensuous existence which has ceased to throw itself enthusiastically into its object. Thus perish individuals, thus perish peoples, by a natural death. And though the latter may continue in being, it is an existence without intellect or vitality, having no need of its institutions, because the need for them is satisfied, a political nullity and tedium. In order that a truly universal interest may arise, the spirit of a people must advance to the adoption of some new purpose. But whence can this new purpose originate? It would be a higher, more comprehensive conception of itself, a transcending of its principle. But this very act would involve a principle of a new order, a new national spirit. Such a new principle does, in fact, enter into the spirit of a people that has arrived at full development and self-realization. It dies not a simply natural death, for it is not a mere single individual, but a spiritual generic life. In its case, natural death appears to imply destruction through its own agency. The reason of this difference from the single natural individual is that the spirit of a people exists as a genus and consequently carries within it its own negation in the very generality which characterizes it. A people can only die a violent death when it has become naturally dead in itself, as, for example, the German imperial cities, the German imperial constitution. It is not of the nature of the all-pervading spirit to die this merely natural death. It does not simply sink into the senile life of mere custom, but, as being a national spirit belonging to universal history, attains to the consciousness of what its work is. It attains to a conception of itself. In fact, it is world historical, only insofar as a universal principle has lain in its fundamental element, in its grand aim, only so far is the work which such a spirit produces a moral, political organization. If it be mere desires that impel nations to activity, such deeds pass over without leaving a trace, or their traces are only ruin and destruction. Thus, it was first Chronos, time, that ruled. The golden age, without moral products, and what was produced, the offspring of that Chronos, was devoured by it. It was Jupiter, from whose head Minerva sprang, and to whose circle of divinities belongs Apollo and the Muses, that first put a constraint upon time, and set a bound to its principle of decadence. He is the political god who produced a moral work, the state. In the very element of an achievement, the quality of generality of thought is contained. Without thought, it has no objectivity. That is its basis. The highest point in the development of a people is this: to have gained a conception of its life and condition, to have reduced its laws, its ideas of justice and morality to a science. For in this unity of the objective and subjective lies the most intimate unity that spirit can attain to in and with itself. In its work, it is employed in rendering itself an object of its own contemplation, but it cannot develop itself objectively in its essential nature, except in thinking itself. At this point, then, spirit is acquainted with its principles, the general character of its acts. But at the same time, in virtue of its very generality, this work of thought is different in point of form from the actual achievements of the national genius, and from the vital agency by which those achievements have been performed. We have then before us a real and an ideal existence of the spirit of the nation. If we wish to gain the general idea and conception of what the Greeks were, we find it in Sophocles and Aristophanes, in Thucydides and Plato. In these individuals, the Greek spirit conceived and thought itself. This is the profounder kind of satisfaction which the spirit of a people attains. But it is ideal, and distinct from its real activity. At such a time, therefore, we are sure to see a people finding satisfaction in the idea of virtue, putting talk about virtue, partly side by side with actual virtue, but partly in the place of it. On the other hand, pure universal thought, since its nature is universality, is apt to bring the special and spontaneous, belief, trust, customary morality, to reflect upon itself and its primitive simplicity, to show up the limitation with which it is fettered, partly suggesting reasons for renouncing duties, partly itself demanding reasons, and the connection of such requirement with universal thought. And not finding that connection, seeking to impeach the authority of duty generally, as destitute of a sound foundation. At the same time, the isolation of individuals from each other and from the whole makes its appearance. Their aggressive selfishness and vanity, their seeking personal advantage and consulting this at the expense of the state at large, that inward principle, in transcending its outward manifestations, is subjective also in form, namely, selfishness, and corruption, in the unbound passions and egotistic interests of men. Zeus, therefore, who is represented as having put a limit to the devouring agency of time, and stayed this transiency by having established something inherently and independently durable, Zeus and his race are themselves swallowed up, and that by the very power that produced them, the principle of thought, perception, reasoning, insight derived from rational grounds and the requirement of such grounds. Time is the negative element in the sensuous world. Thought is the same negativity, but it is the deepest, the infinite form of it, in which therefore all existence generally is dissolved. First, finite existence, determinate, limited form, but existence generally, in its objective character, is limited. It appears, therefore, as a mere datum, something immediate, authority, and is either intrinsically finite and limited, or presents itself as a limit for the thinking subject, and its infinite reflection on itself. But first, we must observe how the life which proceeds from death is itself, on the other hand, only individual life, so that, regarding the species as the real and substantial in this vicissitude, the perishing of the individual is a regress of the species into individuality. The perpetuation of the race is, therefore, none other than the monotonous repetition of the same kind of existence. Further, we must remark how perception, the comprehension of being by thought, is the source and birthplace of a new, and in fact higher, form, in a principle which, while it preserves, dignifies its material. For thought is that universal, that species which is immortal, which preserves identity with itself. The particular form of spirit not merely passes away in the world by natural causes in time, but is annulled in the automatic self-mirroring activity of consciousness. Because this annulling is an activity of thought, it is at the same time conservative and elevating in its operation. While, then, on the one side, spirit annuls the reality, the permanence of that which it is, it gains, on the other side, the essence, the thought, the universal element of that which it only was, its transient conditions. Its principle is no longer that immediate import and aim which it was previously, but the essence of that import and aim. The result of this process is then that spirit, in rendering itself objective and making this its being an object of thought, on the one hand, destroys the determinate form of its being, on the other hand, gains a comprehension of the universal element which it involves, and, thereby, gives a new form to its inherent principle. In virtue of this, the substantial character of the national spirit has been altered. That is, its principle has risen into another, and in fact, a higher principle. It is of the highest importance in apprehending and comprehending history to have and to understand the thought involved in this transition. The individual traverses as a unity various grades of development and remains the same individual. In like manner also does a people, till the spirit which it embodies reaches the grade of universality. In this point lies the fundamental, the ideal necessity of transition. This is the soul, the essential consideration of the philosophical comprehension of history. Spirit is essentially the result of its own activity. Its activity is the transcending of immediate, simple, unreflected existence, the negation of that existence, and the returning into itself. We may compare it with the seed, for with this the plant begins, yet it is also the result of the plant's entire life. But the weak side of life is exhibited in the fact that the commencement and the result are disjoined from each other. Thus also is it in the life of individuals and peoples. The life of a people ripens a certain fruit. Its activity aims at the complete manifestation of the principle which it embodies. But this fruit does not fall back into the bosom of the people that produced and matured it. On the contrary, it becomes a poison draught to it. That poison draught it cannot let alone, for it has an insatiable thirst for it. The taste of the draught is its annihilation, though at the same time the rise of a new principle. We have already discussed the final aim of this progression. The principles of the successive phases of spirit that animate the nations in a necessitated gradation are themselves only steps in the development of the one universal spirit, which through them elevates and completes itself to a self-comprehending totality. While we are thus concerned exclusively with the idea of spirit, and in the history of the world regard everything as only its manifestation, we have, in traversing the past, however extensive its periods, only to do with what is present. For philosophy, as occupying itself with the true, has to do with the eternally present. Nothing in the past is lost for it, for the idea is ever present. Spirit is immortal. With it, there is no past, no future, but an essential now. This necessarily implies that the present form of spirit comprehends within it all earlier steps. These have indeed unfolded themselves in succession, independently. But what spirit is, it has always been essentially. Distinctions are only the development of this essential nature. The life of the ever-present spirit is a circle of progressive embodiments, which, looked at in one aspect, still exist beside each other, and only as looked at from another point of view appear as past. The grades which spirit seems to have left behind it, it still possesses in the depths of its present. And Introduction to The Philosophy of History by Georg Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel, translated by J. Sibri. This recording is in the public domain.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.